In the name of God, the beneficent, the merciful, the creator and sustainer of the universe, peace and blessings upon the servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Ameen. I greet you with a greeting that is common in Islam, Assalamu Alaikum, which means peace be unto you. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we have our third program in our series dealing with the economic system of Islam. Today we'll be looking at the topic of work in Islam. I have joining me on the program, as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, Assalamu Alaikum.
Alaykum Assalam wa rahmatullah.
Could I have you very quickly, as is our fashion, summarize the main points that we touched on in our second program in the series dealing with the economic system of Islam?
Certainly. The second program dealt mainly with the concept of property, right of property in Islam. And we indicated that Islam recognizes the right of people to own property as an instinctive, natural tendency among all people. However, we said there are also various levels of property that we can speak about, things that are owned by one individual, by family, by tribe, by a nation or society at large, or jointly owned by the entire human race, like oceans. We give examples of that. Secondly, we talked about the fact that the recognition of the right to own in Islam is also subject to legitimacy of obtaining or acquiring this property, using this property and disposing of it. We have given specific examples as to what is regarded as legitimate in Islam,
yes,
such as obtaining property through one's own effort, hunting, fishing, labor that you do for a pay, for salary or whatever. On the other hand, we have also given the other side of the coin. What means are regarded as illegitimate or unlawful from the point of view of Islamic law to acquire property such as theft, extortion, and all other illegitimate means. And then we said that this restriction do not preclude also that even when you own the right, you own the property rightfully, I should say, there are also obligations and duties on that property, including the, for example, zakah or the charity, the appointed minimum purchases that you have to pay, the obligation to maintain your immediate family and, in some cases, even some of the needy relatives. And we said that, on the whole, this is within the boundaries not just of legal provisions, but there are also additional ethical or moral teachings, if you will, pertaining to the question of acquisition of property, the obligation not to hold property away from circulation and get the society to benefit from the wealth that's available. Not necessarily owned by charity, but at least by way of investment to provide jobs and opportunities and benefits for others.
Mm-hmm. Well, turning to today's topic and to put our discussions into context, I wonder if I could ask you to give some explanation of the Islamic concept of work and who is a worker from the Islamic perspective.
Okay. It appears that this topic of this program seems to follow rather nicely from the previous one because, as indicated before, of course, one of the main sources of legitimate rights of property in Islam is the labor of working. Yes. Well, in an Islamic understanding, labor can be defined as any effort, physical and or mental, that is exerted by the person, which would include the conventional definition of labor that most people would think of immediately, like manual labor. When we say labor, most people think of as manual. This is only one part of it. But it also includes other types of exertion, like mental effort, all jobs that might fall under clerical, professional, managerial, would come under this definition of labor too. But in Islam, even you can add to this the labor or work of people who are appointed or entrusted with some duties in public offices. Even rulers. A ruler in Islam can also be called a worker. That might sound rather strange, you know, but there was a little incident that happened in the days of Muawiyah, the fifth ruler after Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And one time he was sitting there, and a man, a very pious and courageous Muslim by the name of Abu Muslim, entered in his court, and he said to him, "Assalamu alayka ayyuha al-ajir." The word ajir in Arabic means workers. He says, "Peace be upon you, workers." So the people, of course, around the ruler were offended from that. He said, "You don't mean ajir, which means worker. You mean amir, which means like a ruler, you know, the commander." He said, "No, peace be upon you, ajir, which means workers." And then later, Muawiyah called his people. He said, "No, listen, he knows what he's saying." And then that courageous man said to him, "Listen to the ruler." He said to the ruler, "You are a worker, and God has appointed you, it's like hired you. And if you do your duty properly as a ruler, God will give you abundant rewards. And if you don't do it right, God will punish you." So this is the kind of conception that they had, that any kind of work, not just manual or mental, any kind of activity that is beneficial to the rest of the community was regarded as work. It follows from this definition that, first of all human beings can be said to be equal in that sense. Equal in the sense that they have the dignity, that all of them are workers, because nobody is exempt or can live without some kind of exertion of effort, except of course in their cases like disabilities. But otherwise, all humans are workers in that sense. And that's that there is no concept in Islam of one class in society or one group being above the other or superior to other or inferior to other. All are common in that particular description. It follows from that also, if you compare it with the contemporary scene, that in an ideal Islamic society that Islam teaches, there is no subdivision that these are the group or the class of entrepreneurs or managers and these are the workers. There is no such division. Like, all of them are workers, maybe in different levels, maybe they're doing different things, but they are all called workers in that sense.
Mm-hmm. But what about the question of work ethics? How would you characterize Islam's attitude towards work?
Well, the interesting thing about it is that Islam does not only appeal, when we talk about work ethics, only in a sense of decency or fair play, that everybody should work and you should not be lazy. This is a kind of common statements that are usually related to the question of work ethics. In Islam, work ethics is carried even a step further, to the point of being equated with worship. In fact, as you might recall from some programs in long time ago dealing with the moral system in Islam, it was indicated that the concept of worship in Islam is not confined to certain rituals or performance of prayers. This is only part of it. But in the true Islamic understanding, every activity that's beneficial to oneself, one family, one society, or to humanity at large, can be regarded as an act of worship, provided two things: good intention, and to do that effort or activity in the within the boundaries that God has established for us. Mm-hmm. So everything can be regarded as an act of worship, including work. So work is worship in that sense. Which means that when the person is taught this basic ethical value of work, or work ethics, if you will, it is related to one's duty towards God, before talking about his duty towards other human beings, that God wanted him to work. In fact, one verse in the Quran says, وَقُلْ أَعْمَلُوا فَسَيَرَ اللَّهُ عَمَلَكُمْ وَرَسُولُهُ وَالْمُؤْمِنُونَ. Says, say, work. Tell them, Muhammad, teach them, work, exert. Which means exertion in everything, in worship, in activities, in good deeds, in moral behavior, as well as economic activity. Work, so that God will, and his messenger, and the believers will see the fruits or the results of your work. It follows from this, of necessity, that Islam discourages the attitude of idleness, or laziness, or attitude of trying to live on the charity of other people. Of course, unless the person is disabled, then he has no means. But this, but otherwise an able-bodied person is not encouraged to just live at the expense of others. Indeed, one incident happened during the lifetime of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that was narrated in At-Tirmidhi and An-Nasa'i. This man came to the Prophet and he was just asking for some kind of charity. The Prophet looked at him and says, "Do you have any property?" He says, "No." Then he repeated again, "Do you have any property? Think, anything." He said, "I have nothing." He said, "All I have is just a kind of mat that me and my wife would sit on it, on one part of it, and cover ourselves with the other half, and we have also kind of pots from which we drink. I don't have anything." He said, "All right, bring them. Bring them here." He brought them. And then the Prophet says, "Who would like to buy this thing, that stuff?" So people bought that, and the result was 2 dirhams. This is the kind of currency that they have. 2 dirhams. So the Prophet looked at this man and said, "All right, take one of those dirhams, this money, and buy food for your family. And take the other dirham and go and buy a metal axe, you know, this axe, and bring it to me." So the man went, he bought the food for his family, brought the metal axe. The Prophet brought the piece of wood and fixed this in the axe and said, "All right, take that axe. And I don't want to see your face for 15 days. Go away, cut wood, and sell it." So the man went. After 15 days, he came back. And this time he was really wealthy, at least compared to his previous state. He had 10 dirhams.
Yes.
10. And the Prophet asked him, "How did you get that?" He said, "Right, I was, you know, cutting wood, and God has blessed my efforts, and now I have this excess amount of money." The Prophet looked at him and says, "This is better for you than coming in the day of judgment with your face having the stigma of sign of begging." This was a very, you know, constructive lesson in trying one that even though the person may be really in a bad shape, one should exert as much effort as possible to try to gain an honorable type of employment. Actually, the Prophet said that even in a more straightforward saying, and he said that it is better for one of you to take his rope, go to the mountain, cut wood, and sell it, than asking people or begging people, waiting whether they are going to give him or decline to give him.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, nearly all cultures and civilizations, there are some people who look down on manual labor. What is Islam's position with respect to manual labor?
Okay, we have seen first in the previous question how the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, responded to this idea of working, and we consider that a very honorable thing, even though, as you know, wood cutting is not that easy type of job. But I'm glad that you're asking the question in the form of what Islam says, rather what Muslims do, or what kind of attitude, because Muslims, like everybody else, also have their own faults, and there might be some Muslims who are guilty themselves of harboring an attitude towards labor or manual labor which is not taught by Islam. So what is more important is to see what Islam teaches and then hold them accountable,
yes,
to the extent they are complying with the teaching of their faith. But if you refer to the teaching of Islam in the primary sources, in the Quran and the prophetic tradition, we find that manual labor is not only acceptable, it is respected and adored.
Mm-hmm.
In the famous story about Prophet Noah, when he was building the ark, the Quran says, وَيَسْمَعُ الصَّوْتِ, he was making an ark. So here is a great prophet, a messenger of God, one of the five greatest prophets. And he's cutting wood and making an ark with the help of others. There's no nothing wrong with it. In one saying of the Prophet narrated in Bukhari, he says that a person would not eat better food than that which is earned from the work of his hand. In amal yadik, from the work of his hand. And similar saying also, and then let me just quote a few. He says, he who sleeps or, you know, starts his evening with his hand tired of work, he will spend his night with his sins and mistakes forgiven. That is, this is the reason of forgiveness of his sins. One time the Prophet was asked, what kind of earning is best? What is the most noble type of earning? He said, from the man or the person working with his hand, and also from an honest sale, an income that comes from honest commercial dealing. One time a companion of the Prophet came to shake hands with him, and the Prophet noted that his hand was really rough and to some extent blistered. And he said, what happened to your hand, Saad? He said, well, because of, you know, my effort to earn living for myself and my children. The Prophet kissed that hand, and he said, this is a hand which is loved by God and his messenger. This attitude has not been restricted or confined to the lifetime of the Prophet, but you find anytime, anywhere, when there are true Muslims, practicing Muslims, you find that the respect for labor, all types of labor, including manual labor, is so great. Just to give you one illustration, after the Prophet, during the reign of the second Caliph, Umar, once he passed by a group of people who were sitting there, putting their heads like that, and, you know, reciting prayers and all that. And he said, who are those people? He was told that these people called themselves Al-Mutawakkilun. Mutawakkilun means those who depend on God. He said, no, these are not Mutawakkilun. These are Muta'akkilun. Muta'akkilun in Arabic means those who are eating away the property of others. In other words, living on charity. Muta'akkilun, not Mutawakkilun. And he said, should I tell you as to who the true Mutawakkil are, or the people who really depend on God? They said, yes. He said, the true people who depend on God are those who put the seed in the ground and then depend on God. That's a good lesson. Mm-hmm. What he's really saying is that to depend on God does not mean that you have to be fatalistic or lazy or do nothing. But try first. That's like the farmer puts the seed. Yes, you have to depend on God to have the plant come out. But do your best. Put the seed, put the fertilizers, you know, give it water and all that. And then depend on God. Do something first before you say, all right, I depend on God for my living. We all depend on God for our living, but we have to do something.
Yeah. Well, to pursue this point with respect to the attitude of manual labor, some argue that there are a few texts in the Quran and in the prophetic sayings which appear to discourage certain kinds of work. How would you respond to people who would respond to those references?
Well, usually the when things are taken out of the context and out of the total frame of reference, you're right, some people come with this kind of conclusion. I think the question is quite common. But, for example, some people refer to the Quran and they say that in numerous places in the Quran, it always speaks about the importance of the life hereafter, that we're going to die, we're going to resurrect again, and this life would be nothing. And there are several prophetic traditions also showing that in our life here on earth, it's just like a traveler who stops under a tree for a short time to rest. It's just small as compared to eternal life in the hereafter. But again, this does not mean that we have to do nothing to earn our living or to be comfortable also while on earth. It simply means put your life in perspective.
Yes.
Don't forget life hereafter because you're too busy getting the maximum joy of this life. But then say don't have any joy. Of this permissible, of course, and innocent enjoyment of life. The other thing also that could be, that sometimes is referred to, is one verse in the Quran that refers to the importance of leaving everything, leaving shade at the time of the Jum'ah or Friday congregational prayer. You know, every week we have to do this congregational prayer. But that very same chapter that deals with this also speaks about the necessity of spreading on the earth after you finish your prayer and seek the provision of that. So it's just that hour or so that you have to spend in prayer. But it doesn't really discourage commercial dealing as such. It simply says, don't forget other activities also. In some saying of the Prophet, he speaks about merchants and say that they would all be condemned, but he again says, except those who are God conscious, God fearing, and those who are truthful in their dealing. So it does not really discourage commercial dealing, but discourage cheating and improper negotiations or contracts. Some of the same also as one narrated, for example, in Ahmad, which may give the indication that the Prophet discouraged people from engaging in agriculture. But that the context of that saying is the people who keep close to land as an allegory of people who avoid also traveling or avoid also struggling or fighting for the sake of God whenever the need arises, like defense and all that. So it's not condemnation of agriculture as such, as how could people survive it.
Yes.
It's talking about people who keep, you know, stationary without really defending themselves or trying to do something for the benefit of other people. So the restrictions that the Islam speaks about with respect to labor are something within the context of Islam, does not mean at all discouragement of activities or any sector of the economy, but simply putting things in proper aid.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in closing to that answer about restrictions. Are there certain types of work in Islam that are subject to restrictions?
Yes, and that comes all like we discussed in the previous program also on the rights of property. It emanates from the basic moral and ethical orientation of Islam. Just to give you an example, even though this was mentioned before, I just have to make cross-reference. To earn money, for example, or to work, for example, in the production and distribution, and or distribution, I should say, of alcoholic beverages, drugs, and I'm referring to harmful drugs, you know, things that people take for this house, intoxicants in general, would be something that is unlawful. A Muslim should not, for example, work in a winery or a beer making plant. Because the output, it's not that the work itself is forbidden, but because the output itself is unlawful as far as Islamic law is concerned. There are also certain restrictions which are meant for the welfare of the public or welfare of society at large. This is what you might call in modern terms like health and safety regulations.
Yes.
Under Islamic law, and this is an old thing, it's nothing new really, the ruler can impose certain restrictions about people having factories in given areas, having so much smoke that might be hurting people without having to do something about it. The protection, health protection, and safety protection for workers. These are all restrictions not on labor itself, but on the way of using people to do work in such a way that as to protect them and to protect the workers of the society at large.
Mm-hmm. Now, within the permissible work, are there any restrictions with respect to the choice of professions, or is the freedom of choice of professions encouraged?
Okay, since you defined it already, within the permissible, there is no restriction on what kind of profession a person may engage in. The basic rule is that a person is free to choose his profession. Under Islamic law, it goes even beyond that. It makes it incumbent on the ruler or government to open the opportunities for people so that they can pursue whatever activities or profession they feel they can do an excellent job on. There is no aristocracy in Islamic law that the certain professions, as used to be in the past, for example, in some places, that professions of certain types have to be limited to one particular group or race or class in society. It should be open to all. This is in recognition simply that God has created humans differently. Some people have more physical aptitudes, manual aptitudes, intellectual aptitudes. There are all kinds of skills that are needed to keep life going. In fact, the Quran in one particular verse in chapter 6 be among the most noble and the most powerful of the aristocratic quote-unquote Qurayshite tribe. So this reflects simply the ideology of Islam of equating between people and making a distinction only insofar as piety and productivity of the person insofar as what he or she can contribute to the well-being of the society at large.
Mm-hmm. What basis is there for differentials in pay?
Well, while Islam equates between people in terms of social status and their position before God, it does not necessarily mean that each person would have to be paid exactly the same as somebody else. Differential in pay could be legitimate on the basis of difference in the quantity of production, the quality, and scarcity. For example, if it takes a long time to get a training to be a brain surgeon, for example, well, you have to be rewarded. And why Islam does not object to this differential, fair differential, which is based on good reasons, is to encourage people to benefit society from their skills or ability, because if you say everybody would be paid the same, then people would take the easier type of professions rather than the ones that require some hard work or long type of training.
What does Islam say about the protection of the rights of workers?
Well, there are several ones. To start with, any worker that you hire, of course, you have some kind of contractual agreement, whether verbal or written or oral. Well, in this we find that the fifth chapter in the Quran says that it is an obligation on the Muslim to fulfill the conditions of contracts. So that is part of it, including work contracts. But even in contracts which are permissible in Islam, we find that Islam also requires that the person should not cheat the people he's hiring. In one saying of the Prophet narrated in Bukhari, he says, among three people the Prophet will cheat against in the Day of Judgment is a person who hires a worker to do work for him and take all the work and effort from him and then does not pay him his due rights. In one saying of the Prophet, he says that you should give the person you hire to do work his payment before his sweat dries. What he really means is that you don't unduly delay the pay, but of course if both agree that the payment would be every week, 2 weeks, or every month, that's fine, but the idea he must be dragged and delay the payment of the due rights of people. In addition to this, we find that other saying of the Prophet seem to imply protection of the weaker segments in society, or people who are prone to exploitation, like women and children. And finally, maybe you can add this too, that in some saying of the Prophet, he indicates that when you hire someone, don't overcharge them with work. Don't really require them to exert undue efforts without justification. But if you give them really work that is very hard beyond their capacity, you should also give them a hand and help them. And that again reflects this egalitarian attitude in terms of at least treatment and the respect of all types of labor.
Time for the day is gone. We want to thank you for watching. We'll invite you back next week when we continue our discussion of the economic system in Islam. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Keep tuned. Allahu Akbar.